This is The Conversation. It's episode 204 with Nina Cacciadorian. She is a Brooklyn artist who is also gradually making her way to living in Berlin as well. We talk about that quite a bit. We also talk about several of her projects, including most notably the installation that she and a collaborator did back in the 90s that came out of a fictional apartment listing, and the answering machine messages they got that came from that. We also talk about her more current project, the On Hold Music Dance Party, which she and a couple of collaborators are performing in various locales, and you will get a taste of those samplings at the end of the show. And ultimately, I would say we talk about what it's like being a mobile traveling artist and where you draw the line on place and home. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is still theconversationpod.com, where you can go check out images of various projects of Nina's, including that apartment recreation, the animal crossdressers, and her various projects that come out of travel and airplanes. You can also check out her cat Stickies alongside his German cat food and a couple of cross-cultural cat food comparisons. Stickies, by the way, made it over to Berlin, where he is now making his home. You will hear about that as well. On the back end, I am, in addition to sharing a good chunk of one of the On Hold Music Dance Party performances, we're going to talk about the t-shirt that is coming to life, coming to fruition, the Conversation Podcast t-shirt, which, to give you a little extra teaser, has the infamous P word on the front. So more on that on the back end, but definitely stay tuned for that. I want you guys to be fully informed about what your options are with these t-shirts that Patrick Kamut, a high school art teacher in Pittsburgh, helped initiate as a project. So stay tuned for that on the back end as well. For now, let us get to the conversation with Nina. Thank you very much for being here, and I'll talk to you more on the back end.
Hello.
Hello, it's Michael.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. How about yourself?
Good. I'm good, thanks. Yeah.
So you know where we're going to start, right? we're in Brooklyn, right? With Nina?
We're in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yep, I'm in Brooklyn.
What part of Brooklyn?
I'm in Borum Hill, Brooklyn.
Okay.
Three stops in on the F train three on the A.
Right, yeah. Right. So one of your slightly fancier, more gentrified, longer gentrified sections of Brooklyn, perhaps.
Well, I'd say when I moved here a little over 20 years ago, it was sort of starting to gentrify, and now it's gone completely crazy.
Yeah.
One thing that makes it kind of interesting to live on my particular block is that I'm across the street from a really, really big housing project, and there's another one down the street. So it's actually sort of I feel like I'm sort of on the edge of a fancy neighborhood on one side, and then a lot of people who are struggling often on the other, which sometimes has made this a complicated place to live, actually.
Huh. That's fascinating. So you're really bridging two worlds geographically, in a sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's sort of, you're kind of pretty close to, when things get economically tough in this country, and a lot of people begin feeling miserable because of that. It's, you know, I feel like my neighbors across the street feel miserable first. And when there's a drug epidemic, they're feeling it first. And so there's sort of a strange strange conversations I've had over the years where friends who even live a few blocks away are like, what? There was a shooting last night? I didn't hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, well, I heard it right outside my window. So,
right.
New York is, to reiterate a cliche, but it is a very sort of strangely quickly changing neighborhood situation in places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how it, I was going to ask you how it manifests the, you know, those extremes. And it sounds like one example is a gunshot that you can hear.
Yeah. I mean, I have been here now. Yeah. Like I said, a little over 20 years, there have been more shootings than I can keep track of. And it's just one of the things that upsets me the most right now about, I don't know, I guess you could say in general about this country is the whole gun problem, but
yeah.
I'm really, really aware of it given the fact that, you know, the night of the last shooting, there was a friend who had been here for dinner, you know, parked his car a few blocks away and had driven away just a half hour earlier when these two guys got shot, like more or less right there in their car. So, you know, it's a lot of people's reality that I get to be insulated from a lot of the time, but not always right here. So, you know, it's one of those things that gives me pause. I think I've mentioned to you that I live part of the year now in Berlin and spent the summer there. And one of the things over the summer was just realizing I'm not walking around here thinking about guns all the time. It was, I hadn't realized I was. But, you know, in relief, it was sort of suddenly like, geez, I mean, it's crazy what we get used to here.
Yeah. So when you say that you realize how much you're thinking about guns, just to break it down, how much are you thinking about guns and cognizant of guns as compared to just simply feeling unsafe? How much are they intertwined as a feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I perhaps because I'm a bit of a Pollyanna with my, you know, head in the clouds a lot of the time, I really don't sort of feel directly unsafe or threatened, but that's sort of absurd because I think there are probably more guns around me than I care to think about or count.
I was just trying to get a sense of how you are taking in this gun and, you know, murder or shooting situation in relation to the process of thinking about guns, you know, which is kind of a sociological kind of process versus simply on a personal level feeling unsafe.
I mean, I think I feel this, I guess, thinking back to, again, the things I feel like I realized through the summer is that it's just a culture that is so addicted to violence, but also sort of where the antidote to that violence is a weapon, which is crazy to me. So it's just, I don't know. I just kept thinking, like, the thing that makes people then feel safe is having a gun. And then we are round and round in this crazy carousel. So, it's depressing. It's incredibly upsetting to me that somehow there's this kind of strange cycle that feels very hard to break. And it's more than just about kind of a, the guys doing the shooting and getting shot across the street, is there's a lot of gang stuff, but, you know, it doesn't mean that my friend who was walking to his car isn't going to end up catching a stray bullet. So there's sort of all of that. And I mean, frankly, it just upsets me that a bunch of like 17 or 18 year old men get shot a lot. Like, obviously that's horrible. And anyway, without sort of getting on a soapbox about all the facts and figures we already know. And
yes.
But it's just like, it just seems very, very unnecessary. And when people say that, I always think there's a sort of, it should be a simple problem to solve. And I know that it's obviously not, but it saddens me tremendously. So,
is your studio within your home, or is it another location?
No, it was for years, and for years I also sort of said, well, you know, I'm not really the kind of artist who needs a studio. The kinds of things I make are, it's more about sort of being in front of a computer and doing kind of a type of office work or research almost.
Right.
The work sort of ends up being made or happens external to the studio. But about 10 years ago, I decided that it was starting to, frankly, become a bit awkward to have people over to my house. And I wasn't really feeling like these studio visits happening in my strange little crowded basement where it sort of felt unprofessional suddenly and a little bit awkward. And like I wanted a little more privacy around my work versus home life. I ended up getting a studio down the street where I've now been for a while, and it was really a revelation that it was so much more than just kind of having a space to work in, but a mental separation and a place to go where I could kind of, you know, avoid some of the other things that would distract me from getting my artwork done at home. And so it's been a wonderful thing to have this studio. And I will also say that after about 15 years of working in a basement space with no natural light, I have a fourth floor space now with huge windows where I have an amazing giant view, and it's so much better for the mental health too.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
It feels like payback.
And is that a designated commercial building, or what?
It is. Well, it's sort of It is sort of being lived in partially by some of the there's 16 of us who are actually owner occupiers. We're really, really fortunate to have managed to find a way collectively to buy this building about 12 years ago, actually now. So yeah, we're there and we're watching the Gowanus, you know, neighborhood of Brooklyn change around us rapidly. It's there was a very fancy restaurant that opened across the street a year after a fancy ice cream place opened and the shuffleboard place, and now there are condos going up. And you know, as of 2 weeks ago, they've just started dredging the Gowanus Canal because it got declared a Superfund site. And you know, I think real estate developers have stars in their eyes about this. The thing we laugh at is that they say it's going to be the Venice of Brooklyn. We're like, Yeah, maybe someday. But
so just
so
a I'm sorry. I was just going to go back to your studio. So you say you're all owner occupiers. Does that basically mean that you bought a commercial space as a group and then divvied up?
We did collectively, and people bought very different amounts of space. Like there are people who bought, you know, there's sort of four floors, and each floor is divided into quadrants. So some people bought, you know, one quadrant, one unit. Other people bought three units. Other people bought a third of one unit. So there's sort of really, really different allocations of space. And there are a couple of businesses in the building. There's a stone carver. There's a potter. There's a framer. My framer, conveniently, is one floor below me, which is the greatest thing.
Right.
A magazine runs out of the building. There's a conservancy, the Gowanus Canal Conservancy is in our building. And then one of the funniest things, you know, I mean, you become an owner-occupier and suddenly you're like, oh, wow, we need a new roof. We need a new elevator. We need a lot of repair to this building. We need to fix the vaults outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been sort of, it's a lot of landlording also over ourselves in a funny kind of way that the last few years have entailed. And I've been on the board a couple of times now, but but we got hit really badly by Hurricane Sandy. That was a very, very unpleasant wake-up call to sort of what it means to be in a flood zone in New York City.
And right.
Our entire electrical system was destroyed. We had to, because it was in the basement, which is, you know, not a great place for the electrical, but, you know, 6 feet of water in the basement, which you never imagine will happen. And we had no electrical. We had no heat. We had nothing for a pretty long time. And so there's a lot of that kind of stuff, a lot of decisions to make. And then on sort of the other end, I'll tell you a funny way that we've discovered we can make some money for the building, which is that we have a very decrepit, kind of scary yet picturesque alleyway between our building and the next one over.
Mm-hmm.
And this alleyway proves to have been now sort of like the fantasy version in a lot of people's minds of what a sort of dangerous New York City alley looks like. So these film scouts keep showing up and asking us if they can rent this alley and do film shoots there. And they pay, you know, handsomely. So we have a kind of fund now that, you know, the building has, which we have now, I think we've now had like five or six major film shoots in this alley, and we're gradually, you know, earning our way towards a new roof, which is fantastic. But it's just such a hilarious way to, we had this kind of weird cash cow we didn't even know on the property. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It makes me think that people should actually approach real estate with film shoot. You could approach it with film shoots in mind and buy something that's sort of, you know, not even the building you're buying, but the kind of like creepy back lot or the creepy alleyway.
Right. But your studio is then, is it walking distance from where you live?
Yeah. You know, I think it's like 8 minutes away. It's super close, 10 blocks away from where I live. Yeah.
But Borham Hill is not really known for artists' studios, but you are fairly close, it sounds like, to Gowanus, which does have a lot of artist studios. Is that right?
Yeah, Gowanus has more industrial space and, you know, rapidly changing, but, you know, still there are a bunch of really big buildings there that have been sort of studio buildings for a long time. So, we're clinging to them as best we can. I mean, we're very, very fortunate. We're not going to get kicked out of our building. I think the more likely thing is that at some point people begin converting it to residential spaces and, you know, it kind of flips internally. But, there's a lot of discussion about that.
That sounds potentially charged between your neighbors.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, can be. Some people, and I think this is sort of the right way to see it, is like, this was bought to be a studio building, and if it's a studio building, then if you choose to live here, you have to be willing to put up with the hammering or the drilling or whatever it is someone's doing in their studio, you know, at odd hours of the day, because primarily, first and foremost, it's still a building that we all work in. And if the living sort of has to be seen as a secondary possibility. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the spirit in which we've all approached it.
Right.
So
right.
far. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about Berlin. So you were, as you told me when we spoke last time as well, you were there over the summer. How often had you spent prior to this past summer? Have you been going several years?
I've been there many times, but really haven't spent extended amount of time there until now. And I mean, I have to say, like, I feel like such a cliche saying I live between Brooklyn and Berlin. It's like vomit. It's like lifestyle predictable cliche. But it is sort of it's not a decision that we made. Sounds like we sort of just picked up and left the summer, but it's been a conversation going on for many years. My husband has been really tired of New York and really wanting a change of scenery. And I sort of, although I felt a little less that way, I haven't been here quite as long as he has. I eventually sort of said, okay, you know, let's sort of try it and see. And the summer was wonderful. So, you know, we were there for 3 months, and I am here in the fall teaching at NYU. I have a wonderful job that I love and don't want to leave. But I only teach in the fall term, which makes it possible to be away the rest of the year. And he is sort of there now, more or less full time. So yeah, so it's a very new chapter, and it's so far been a really nice one. I'm about to kind of finish up the semester and then head over there again in mid-December for a longer stretch. And then I will experience winter, which everybody says is horrible. So we'll see how much I like it.
Yeah. The last time I was in Berlin was October. This is over 10 years ago, but it felt like winter. So yeah, it should be interesting. So, so you really will be living there largely. Part of the context that I bring all this up in is, I have seen a number, as I'm sure you have, CVs or resumes, you know, in the gallery that say, you know, lives in Los Angeles and Berlin, lives in New York and Berlin. And first of all, why would you admit to that, as you sort of alluded to earlier? But second of all, talk about, and maybe it's a little early for you to talk about it, but I mean, what is it like being an, is there a cosmopolitan, you know, traveling band of artists that, you know, you run into over there that you see in New York as well? Or is it more like a totally different scene? How would you describe it?
I mean, there are tons of Americans there. It's, you know, almost sometimes a little bit irritating where you sort of feel like I wish that, I don't know, I can kind of imagine for the Berliners, the native Berliners, it might be kind of annoying, basically having all of us over there. And I think that at the same time, you know, it's a very, yes, it is a very cosmopolitan city. It's funny, I'm struck by its diversity. It's a certain kind of diversity there. But I have to say, I was also really, really struck coming back here to New York in the sort of the different diversity here. It feels still sort of to me more racially diverse here. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if it was just the neighborhoods that I was in, but this still in some ways feels like a city where there are more people from all over the world than Berlin does. But it's also, what also took me by surprise was that it felt very familiar to me, in part because, you know, half of my family is Finnish, and I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia growing up, a lot of time in Europe growing up, and there was something sort of like, oh, right, I have sort of been around. It was really almost like physical material things, like this particular type of granite cobblestone is really familiar, or the way that they, like, I mean, this sounds really strange, but like wire electricity through an apartment, or little very concrete details like that. And and so it wasn't actually in some ways as foreign as I might have expected it to feel. So I'm trying to kind of at the moment be a little bit more malleable and flexible about the way that I see location. And I'm trying to sort of have a little bit of a lighter footprint in the way that I live, where I have less stuff and just some stuff over there and some stuff over here, and try to kind of shed the need to accumulate a lot of things. It feels really, really nice to do that right now. So I can just kind of be nimble about going back and forth.
Yeah, and your work, from what I gather of it, is very amenable to a light, you know, not having a bunch of stuff in storage, correct? correct?
Yeah, and I think the sort of disorientation that comes from being in a new place and even from, you know, this contact with a language that I don't speak yet. I'm learning German, but I'm really a beginner. That disorientation can sometimes be really productive. So I'm kind of going into the spring, winter, spring, like with a few things I know I need to work on, but then there's sort of a little bit of room to see what else might come up. So that's really nice. I'm really looking forward to that. It's been a little while since I've gotten to do that. So we'll see what happens.
Right.
We'll see where the being lost might lead. Yeah.
Do you feel like that your fellow expats, if you will, are for the most part getting by on just the very basics in as far as German? How many of them do you sense are more advanced and kind of therefore more culturally integrated, if that's even a thing?
I really do notice that. I mean, there are, you know, I know some people there who have been there for 20 years. They have, you know, like a German partner, and they speak really fluent German, and they definitely have, you know, a social world where it's like a combination of Germans and Americans and other people. But you know, like, I know a very established artist who lives there, and sort of like a generation older than me. And you know, he said to me the other day, like, "Oh, you don't need to learn German. I'm not going to learn German. I just speak English with everyone." And it wasn't important to him, and he doesn't really need to. I mean, it's amazing how you can get away without it too. I don't really want to do that. That feels annoying and obnoxious to me. And I like learning languages. I'm looking forward to the experience of getting my head around it. So, but you know, I know that will take some time too. And yeah, there's some moments where it's sort of, you know, it can feel a little lonely not being able to just jump in.
Yeah.
And then there's also sort of something funny where I realized this summer I had such a perception of it as such a quiet city. And it really is in large measure. It's sort of a city with a lot of parks and green spaces, but people don't talk as loud. And I was so struck when I got back to New York at how loud it was, but also suddenly understanding the language everywhere I went, how much people swear and how sort of like coarse what everybody was saying sounded to me. And I was a little, I think, insulated from that, because there was a lot of, you know, incomprehensible German around me this summer. So everything felt very gentle on the ears, I think, for a variety of reasons, some environmental and some linguistic.
Right.
But
well, how much, if you were to guess, how much coarseness do you think is just hidden on the other side of the language barrier?
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I guess that remains to be seen. I can't follow quickly enough along to know.
But as a beginning, you know, beginning to early intermediate German speaker, isn't one of the things that one learns first are many of the curse words?
Yeah, it's sort of the risky thing that always happens.
Right.
You learn obscene words and switch them out with words when you're not trying to be obscene. It's really awful. I've done that in other languages too many times.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned how quieter it is there, and you know, obviously there's that language barrier that maybe you would be hearing more coarseness, but in any case, all I'm trying to get at is there's a certain appeal that we're talking about, and you combine that with what's going on in this country right now. I inevitably would imagine that there's a certain heightened attraction to spending as much time there as possible. No?
Well, sure. In a way, of course, it's sort of, you know, of course, part of me just wants to like flee and not have to think about any of the crap happening here. But you know, I've also come to realize, I will say, that like my identity as an American has deeper roots than maybe I wanted to admit. Like, you know, I am a first generation American. My parents are from elsewhere. Like, I grew up here. I have, you know, very, very close ties here, friends, and so on. But I have to say, like, it was weird how a certain kind of, like, I don't know what to call it, some strange form of patriotism, like, even sort of, like, I sort of found myself, patriotism is a complicated word, but I would find myself sometimes from there thinking about America with a kind of sense of, like, attachment and heartbreak and disappointment, but also kind of, like, there are some things that are really, really special and unique about this place. Like, it wasn't all a kind of like, ugh, I never want to go back there. Like, it was a feeling of like things being very broken, but you know, you can kind of only care about that if you have an attachment that's real and authentic to a place. So, you know, it's like the heartbreak is in inverse proportion to the love of a place. If that
right.
makes sense. So I was really, I mean, you know, I do feel very aware of that right now too. That it's just sad how it feels like so many things have gone derailed and gone astray. But I do care. I'm not sort of willing to like turn my back and.
Yeah.
And, you know, be like, I'm done with this place. So.
Yeah. And that sort of underscores your potential dual citizenship, as it were, you know. Between,
right. You know, and the other profound thing also is that, you know, I teach. And so I'm around young American college students who have to, and look are, you know, most of them likely to make a life here and who I really want to help. I really want them to be able to contribute and be, I mean, you know, whatever I can do for them, I want to do. And I sort of feel like I am becoming like this middle-aged person thinking these crazy things like, it's the next generation who has it in their hands to, you know, do great things. And, you know, if I can have any kind of part in that, that feels very meaningful to me right now. So, investment in New York and, you know, the USA, I guess you could say at the moment, is what I'm trying to do as a teacher.
And are you feeling, in relation to those charges that you're handling, optimistic generally? I mean, is it pretty complicated, the spectrum of what you're experiencing with your young students?
It is complicated, but, you know, I'm very moved by how much right now, and, you know, this is an elite group of students. I mean, you know, it's Gallatin, NYU Gallatin is a very, like, sort of, it's a special little bubble, but that said, I mean, you know, I have students who don't necessarily come from a super privileged background, too, and particularly in this sound art class that I'm teaching right now, I sort of made a point this time through to involve a lot more readings and projects about sound that kind of also have to do with subjectivity, so students could kind of be thinking about what kind of a listener they are and sort of how they've come to be that listener, and that really has to do a lot with both their backgrounds, their lives before they got to college, and also kind of the cultures around them, which aren't, you know, completely homogenous at all in this class. And so I'm really struck by how articulate some of them are about that from whatever perspective they're coming from. I think they're kind of really being, in a hopeful way for me, like trained to think about what they've had and what they haven't had and what that might mean for someone else too. So it's good. I mean, you know, it's complicated. I'm not sure I always lead the conversations in the best possible way. Some of these conversations are hard for me too, but I think it's been amazing the way that some students have been willing to kind of step up and share things that are really quite personal. And that's been great.
Okay.
They can communicate with one another. That's another way of saying it, is I feel like they can communicate pretty well with one another. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. Especially if things get, you know, triggery or what have you.
Yeah.
To use one of the hot topics of today.
That's right.
Hey there. Just a quick break in to let you know that we made a slight conversational topic change here, as you will notice. And also, in about 6 minutes from now, you will hear the line get a little crackly on Nina's end. It turned out that was because her landline phone was running out of batteries, so she switched to another one and the problem went away. So you'll hear maybe a minute or so of the crackly sounds, but it does go away, just to give you a heads up. All right, back to the conversation.
I know a lot of artists who really don't want to be teaching. Like, they really think teaching is sort of like the worst thing you can do to yourself. Like, it just gets in the way of your work. And I've never felt that way. I grew up the kid of a professor. It's probably part of it, is I really love the environment of school. But I also really feel that, you know, I do teach in part largely also sort of by choice. I think it makes me a better artist when I'm teaching and I'm sort of in contact with ideas that my students are trying to develop. And there's just something at best where it becomes a kind of research opportunity for me. And you know, like the ultimate sort of aha was when I was like, oh, actually, this seems really generous, but in fact, it's totally selfish. I just get to propose courses now and then that like align with the research I'm thinking about myself. And in some ways, I know that sounds kind of like very me, but if I'm as engaged as possible in the material I'm teaching, I'm also going to teach the best possible class. So there's been a sort of trick to that of, like, you know, assigning material or projects that I'm also really eager to read or think about and talk about, and then we're kind of all in it together. And that's been great. So I try to sort of, you know, it's funny. I just gave an artist talk, and after it, there was that classic sort of question of, like, do you make a living as an artist? Like, it's like somehow with no other field you get that question, except if you're doing something where people are like, how can that person possibly make a living at it? And I said, you know, well, it depends how you're going to think about the being an artist part. I mean, to me, being a person who teaches art is actually part of my life as an artist. Like, I think of these as connected entities. They're not separate. Other people would be like, yeah, my job is this. And so, I am making a living as an artist with all those different things that involves, teaching being one of them. But
what is the classic explanation from these friends / colleagues of yours who say that teaching is bad for your career, for your the work that you're focusing on?
That it's really hard to put boundaries around it. You know, it's just, it can be this thing that sucks up absolutely every bit of you. And this is true. I mean, I have had semesters. Where I know it. I mean, it's happened to me. I taught too much for a while, and I found that my work suffered for it. Absolutely true. I mean, this is why I'm really fortunate and maybe even able to say what I'm saying, because right now I feel like I teach the right amount. So I can throw myself into it in fall, and it really is kind of like the main thing in the fall. And then the rest of the year, I'm doing something else. And it makes it possible not to grow resentful and lose steam with it, too. So, no, I mean, that's sort of the common thing, is just there's just no time and energy, like mental, emotional energy left over for the studio when your students need so much from you. So I really, I mean, deeply admire the artists I know who teach the whole year round and somehow are able to draw those lines. Maybe because I have the pattern I do, I'm able to also be a little bit more like, you know, I'm pretty available for my students in the fall, like sometimes, you know, probably to a fault, but I don't have to do that the whole year round. So I can kind of be a
But you know, what a place of ultimately, I can't get around that it's such a place of privilege to be able to have that sentiment. Don't go into teaching. It's
for sure.
you know, your boundaries get busted, you know? So what is that person then going to be doing? Well, they're presumably going to be working on their work full time, which is I know more common in New York, but it's still a pretty rare opportunity.
I mean, I had when I was first starting to teach, this was probably what year it was. This was like 2002, I think, when this happened. I got a phone call out of the blue, and it's one of those moments where you're like, oh, I cannot believe this is happening to me. And it was a wonderful foundation called Anonymous Was a Woman, telling me that I had won a grant from them. And it's a grant that you don't know you're nominated for. They it's like winning the sweepstakes. They call you up and they tell you they're giving you a chunk of money. And I was so blown away, and it was sort of like, oh, well, what I'm supposed to do then is, you know, have the semester where I'm just in the studio, like, right? That's what every artist dream is. And it turned out to be a really, really unproductive, you know, half year. It was really bad for me. Yeah. I mean, I didn't get anything done. I was really unmotivated. I didn't have enough contact with people. Like, this kind of, it was a disaster. Like, really, wow. I sort of realized it was really useful to realize this way. But that, for me, it's really not the ideal thing to have kind of like an endless, long, every day in the studio kind of day. Like, I need contact with other humans. I like people. I actually really like being around people intensely for part of the time. And then I also really, really like not being around them. But I like the extremes of that. So I can't have it only be on one end of it. So,
what was the name of that grant?
The grant is called the foundation is called the Anonymous Was a Woman Foundation.
The Anonymous a Woman.
Anonymous Was a Woman, and it's, I really should know this. It's a literary it's a quotation from a literary source, Anonymous Was a Woman.
Got it.
I can look it up later. But
that's okay. Yeah, we'll get it.
They used to give it to a woman artist under the age of 35, and now they've actually changed it so it's over the age of 35. Initially when I got it, I was 35, and then they gave it to now it's over the age of 45, so they've actually raised the age limit. So
Yeah, I mean, about the working schedule, I consistently go back to this experience this old guest of the show had, who's a painter who teaches at a community college full-time and had a sabbatical for a semester, or maybe it was a year. She said it was kind of like too much time, you know, in the studio.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you go from having that sort of contextual structure to having this endless time, as you said, you know, it's just like, unless you have a production line type of studio situation or incredible demand where you're just kind of cranking it out, it does, I get that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I talk a lot about the sort of relationship between freedom and constraint when it comes to some of the projects that I make, and sort of there's a logic of kind of slightly keeping myself away from having everything I need to do something. I mean, you know, maybe the project seat assignment is the best example of that. But I mean, that's sort of true for me in my lived life too. It's like I like to have a sort of wide variety of things going on, and then I sort of sometimes use one to get a little bit away from the other. So there's this kind of, I sometimes call it like productive procrastination that goes on. It's like, oh, I really don't feel like writing that grant application. I'll plan my class instead, you know, or the other way around. So if you can kind of trick yourself into this funny, you know, carousel of, then everything kind of actually ends up getting done.
Well, let's talk about a few of your projects.
Sure.
I want to talk about a couple of audio projects. You did mention that you've been teaching sound, so I think that's appropriate. But one that I'm particularly curious about that goes back a ways is this Wanted project, which
wow.
I can, because I lived in New York for a number of years. I got the Village Voice and looked at apartment ads. So that's, so I go back that far. So why don't you give sort of a basic overview of what this project was?
I rarely get to talk about this one. And one reason I don't often elect to talk about it is that I have very sort of conflicted feelings about it. So I'll tell you, it's
I can imagine.
It's a good one to have picked. So what the project was there was an invitation that came, my way from a guy, an artist named Brian Conley, who then became a good friend, but at the time I didn't know him at all. And he was curating a show for gallery in Brooklyn called Pierogi, which is still around, but way back then was a very, very tiny space. And the idea Brian had was that every artist in the show, and there were going to be about 35 artists in the show, would make a sound piece, and it would be triggered by a motion sensor. So you would sort of walk into this empty gallery with just tons of motion sensors on the wall, and there would be this kind of insane soundscape that would result as you triggered soundtrack after soundtrack after soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And the show is called Constriction. So this kind of thematic of constriction was the kind of prompt. And I ended up collaborating on this piece with my friend Julia Meltzer. And we were both sort of new to New York and were thinking a lot about the problem of finding a place to live, which everybody at that time at our age was sort of contending with constantly. Like, I need cheap rent, I got to find somewhere cheap to live. And that was the ritual. You would go to the Astor Place newsstand, which was the first stand to get the Village Voice, grab it, go to the classifieds, and immediately start calling listings, you know, from some payphone.
I did that.
And my students can't believe it now. Like, it's one of those, whatever, funny generation gap stories where their eyes grow wide.
Or you get to feel really old in front of your students.
Yeah. But I sort of also love bragging about it. It's a little bit of a back-in-the-day moment. You know?
Totally.
So we were very aware of that. And we were very aware of that funny kind of real estate ad language where all the words got kind of compressed into those funny, like, words without vowels. Your would become, you know, Y-O-U-R would become Y-R and so on.
Yeah.
So we wrote an ad that said, Greenwich Village, heart of village, you know, private, quiet, small, colon, 6x9x7 feet, $200 a month, or was it $600 a month?
$600, thanks.
Yeah, it was an extremely affordable, you know, live alone in the West Village kind of place. And we ran that ad, set up an answering machine, and then for the first 24 hours recorded the phone calls, and they came in nonstop. Like, it was, I think we got 118 calls in the first 24 hours. And the outgoing message said,
you know, answering machine style. It said, sorry, you know, missed your call. Leave me a message. If you're calling me at the apartment, please tell me a little bit about yourself and I'll get back to you. So people were sort of prompted to leave. It was like an audition. You know, they would leave these like little commercials for themselves where they would, you know, they would either try to sound, you know, responsible, or they would mention like they, you know, had a good income, or they would try to be really charming and sound super nice and sort of say things about their hobbies and habits. And I mean, some of them verged a little bit on a kind of almost like singles ad mode, like, you know, I'm into cooking and running and,
right,
you know, like, so it was a funny study of the sort of genre of voice message. And then also kind of a study of, in a weird negative space kind of way, like the potential inhabitants of this neighborhood. And so I thought of it, we thought of it as a kind of sonic portrait, also of who might live in this neighborhood. What nobody realized, though, and which we didn't make clear, was that 6 by 9 by 7 feet are the dimensions of a standard American jail cell. So people were basically bending over, you know, falling over themselves to rent this like unlivably small, ridiculously small room.
Right.
And, you know, that's sort of the kind of weird and slightly uncomfortable part of the piece, is that, you know, we're able to sort of like, with levity, sort of think about, imagining in a jail, living in a jail cell. Well, that's not so funny to a lot of people who have to do that. So I don't know. It was a weird piece, and it drew out a kind of curious cruelty in the listener when they stood there and listened to it. And I should also add that we somehow got around the problem of that sound sensor in the exhibition thing, and we managed to find this kind of like closet in the back that had the same proportions as the room. So our piece actually was sort of on its own, and you got to go in there and just hear the soundtrack of all these people who called.
Right.
But you know, there's a kind of, it was a piece where I think we did it without thinking about how it would feel temperamentally once it was done, and once it became a social experience of people sort of standing there and like cackling away, you know, at the people who had called in. And of course, we never called anyone back. I mean, it was also just a tease and a false promise.
Well, and I'm glad you used that word, because that you mentioned an element before we started talking about it that was uncomfortable about it. And for me, that was the big discomfort that you were hazing these people.
Right. It was a lie. I mean, put very simply.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you know, it was a weird experience for us both. We hadn't meant to make a mean piece, and it was sort of in some ways now funny we didn't see that coming, but we were young artists who hadn't made a lot of work yet, and we didn't see it coming, and, you know, we learned a lot from it. I have to say, it's a piece I've shown only a few times since, and it's always sort of a, it's always a little uncomfortable. It's now become kind of nostalgic in a funny way, because there is a back in the day quality to like, oh, remember ads, and oh, remember, you know, when you used to have to call and leave messages like that. And did we really hurt anyone through the piece? No, but you know, there is, it's like there's a sort of ethics to it that's
sketchy at best.
Yeah, it sits weirdly with me still a little bit,
right,
you know?
Yeah. Would you say there are any pieces you've made since that you have any ethical qualms about?
Interesting. This is a very strange one to jump to, but I think the other one that I have sort of been, I've had some moments of kind of questioning myself about it, actually has to do with, it's a totally different kind of project, but it's called Animal Cross-Dressing.
Right.
And it's a project where I had been on a residency in Trinidad, and I'd spent a lot of time at the zoo there, gotten to be friendly with the zookeeper, and he was the guy who actually took care of the snakes. That was his job, the reptile part of the zoo. And many times I saw him feed, you know, rats, mice, guinea pig, even rabbits to the snakes at the zoo, and it was a really strange thing to watch. I mean, especially the day that he said brightly and cheerily, like, today we're feeding the anaconda a rabbit. And I've never seen a snake that big eat something that big. And it was hard to watch, you know. I mean,
yeah,
it's hard not to have a kind of sentimental reaction, although, you know, this is just what happens in nature. But I was interested in that kind of, like, human sentimental response and my desire to meddle in that. And I had this kind of absurd thought that maybe if, like, you could dress up the prey animal to look like a snake, they would sort of slither by and escape. It would be sort of a strategy of masquerade. So I thought, well, I should make an outfit for this rat, for like a rat that would turn it into a snake. And then often for me, I like things to sort of happen in a kind of parallel. So if I sort of do something in one direction, I like to do it in the other. So I thought, well, I should also make, you know, an outfit that turns a snake into a rat, and then maybe it would sort of know what it feels like to be a rat. So I did this, and long story short, it was very difficult to get these photos the way I wanted them in Trinidad, because the working conditions at this zoo was just impossible. There were like zoo visitors watching, and it was really ridiculous. But
right.
I staged it again in Brooklyn with two pet animals. I put ads in pet stores for, you know, does someone have a pet rat? Does someone have a pet snake? And I had a guy with a snake come and dressed up the snake, and we did, it was a very easy photo shoot. Carla, this python, was really, really comfortable in her outfit. I think it was kind of warm and snug, and she actually really quite liked it in there, and it was very easy to get her into it. The rat, on the other hand, didn't have a very good time. And, you know, I was there with the rat's owner, the rat's parent, human parent, mm-hmm. And it, you know, I didn't, I mean, it was really up to him to sort of say, like, now we've had enough, and, but it got a little bit tense, and I sort of, you know, I also really wanted to get this photo, and so, you know, we tried and tried, and the rat was kind of struggling, and eventually I did get it into the costume, and we got the picture, but it felt a little bit like, I don't know, I wondered if I'd sort of traumatized the owner a little bit, even if I hadn't traumatized the rat. It was sort of hard to mm-hmm. really say that the rat, I don't think I really hurt the rat, but I sort of think I kind of hurt the guy, and so, I don't know. That was a strange moment. And I still look at these pictures and kind of, I remember that experience. And once or twice, and it's been really infrequent, but there has been a sort of reaction to that piece where somebody has said, like, this is a humiliation of these two animals. Like, you are humiliating them. You are not taking them seriously. You have done something that's, like, immoral here. And, you know, I mean, I've tried to sort of think about whether I think that's true. I don't ultimately really come down on that side of it, but you know, there's a bit of a, like, I can see why someone would look at this and think that if they didn't know that, you know, no animals were harmed. And there's a kind of, like, I don't know, I think this every time I see, like, a dressed up, you know, little dog or cat or something, where it sort of feels like there's something kind of disrespectful about seeing animals in costume.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, I've thought a lot, I've made a lot of work about the sort of human relationship to, you know, what the term now is, you know, non-human animals. And there's a really interesting essay by John Berger about, called Why Look at Animals? And I've thought a lot about that essay over the years, where he sort of makes the argument that, you know, letting animals be different from us would actually be sort of better for them. And mm-hmm. I'm really kind of summing it up in a broad strokes
sure.
way. But something about that, wanting to put human clothes on them, isn't allowing them that difference. And I sort of really believe in that in some way. I mean, I say this as someone who lives with, well, the cat lives in Berlin now, but, you know, a cat that I miss desperately, who is like our child, and, you know, it's ridiculous. We treat him like, you know, a human, but
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to just about presume that because of all the traveling you do, you didn't have it, but we too have a cat that we pretty much treat like a human. So go on. Go,
yeah.
Please go on.
No, I mean, we're obsessed with our cat. It's just ridiculous how much we love this cat. And,
yeah, yeah.
And he flew to Berlin over the summer, and he lives there now. His lifestyle, like, improved quite a bit moving there.
How was it flying for him?
How was flying for him?
Yeah.
I'd say he kind of hunkered down and got through it. I don't think he loved it.
Right.
He did really, really well. I mean, he was incredibly patient.
Mm.
And I think he actually, what he hated most was the trip in the car to and from the airport. That was awful.
Yeah.
He hates being in cars. But
yeah.
The plane ride, and we bought this amazing cat carrier, which was like a sort of soft duffel bag. And then when you're in the plane, you can unzip both sides and they fold out like a tent.
Mm.
So he had like insane amounts of space. So we had no leg room at all. But he was great. He was just
right.
Stretched out, you know.
Nice.
He was fine. So, yeah.
Nice. Got it. Okay. Well, let's thank you for bringing up another ethically challenging experience in your art making. But
yeah.
One thing that I heard about, and I don't think there's any, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any reference to it on your site, but the whole music project, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I'm so eager to talk about that.
Please.
It's very new and therefore not on my website
right.
yet, but
right.
I got to get around to that. Yeah, it's called the On Hold Music Dance Party, and it's a project that was kind of a response to an invitation from a space in Philadelphia called Temple Contemporary that was doing an entire season of programming on boredom. And they came into the studio visit and sort of told me as much, like, we're working on boredom and we thought of you, which is really, well, I was kind of psyched about that, actually. Like, thank you.
You're a boredom
I'm really
expert.
Interested.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm the go-to boring artist. That's
right.
Great.
That's
you know,
awesome.
Boredom artist. So I said, I'd love to think about that, and thought and thought and thought, and like really was hitting a wall, like nothing interesting was coming to mind. It was really starting to become a problem. Like months had gone by and I had nothing for these guys, and I was sort of thinking, I'm going to have to call them and tell them I just can't do anything. But then there was a day when my husband was on the phone, and he had the phone on speaker. He was calling his doctor's office, and I heard the music emanating from the phone and realized, oh my gosh, I know what that is. I have been on hold with that very music many times. And then the sort of more important light bulb went off, which is that I had just for fun for about the year or two leading up to that point been Shazamming the song with my phone every time I was on a landline on hold, just to kind of see if it was identifiable. I was just curious what the music was. Mm-hmm. That you hear in those situations. Like, mm-hmm. is it a purchasable song? Is it a song that's on an album? Is it written for this context? You know, what kinds of different types of music are there? And I had sort of developed already this on-hold music playlist just for my own amusement, really. That,
right.
But in that moment, I suddenly realized, oh, my God, this is raw material that speaks to the space of boredom. This is stuff I could work with. So I thought about that some more and realized that, you know, well, how are we usually hearing it? We're hearing it while we are sitting down, usually, you know, inert, static, not in motion, kind of physically frustrated, even if we are, like, walking down the street on hold. We're usually kind of, there's this feeling of stasis, you know, and I thought, well, what if I could kind of activate it in a crazy way somehow that would make it actually something activated on every level, including physical. And then I just thought we should try to dance to it. And so it was even something I sometimes did for fun when there was sort of a little like peppy piece of on hold music. I would
right.
sort of like, as a way of almost making fun of it, I would sort of, when alone at home, like dance around to it. So I called the Philadelphia people and proposed this, and they were really into it. And I thought, you know, I think I need to try to work with a DJ because I really haven't tried to make music this way before, although I have made music, but not this way. So I conscripted a friend who's a very serious amateur DJ. His Gabriel Willow is his name. He performs under the name DJ Stylus. And actually, the funny thing about Gabriel is that he's a New York City Audubon guide. So he works as a naturalist leading nature tours, mostly bird tours, by day, and then as a DJ at night. And these are like the most incompatible work hours imaginable because,
right.
you know, one thing ends at like 3 a.m. and the other starts at 5 a.m.
Wow.
So Gabriel and I got together on this and then brought in a friend of his who's an amazing woman named Julie Cavello who performs under the name DJ Shaky, and she has been in the New York DJ scene for a really long time. Like, she is an amazing, very, very experienced professional DJ. And the three of us ended up becoming this little crew who now have put together this party, which we've now performed 3 times. I just did it as part of a show I have in Stanford, California at the Cantor Arts Center, and I'm about to do it with these guys again in New York on December 14th at a party here at a place called The Keep. So what we do is divided up into kind of 3 roles. We've got Gabriel kind of transitioning us from one song in the set to the next, and then Julie is kind of putting various effects or warping filters, different kinds of things, stutters onto the sounds that we're playing live, and then my job is to throw in from this kind of keypad with maybe like 50 samples on it, these little bits of language. So I can play with things like, you know, please hold on in a kind of rhythmic way, or
right.
dial tone, or busy signal, or voice prompts, or different kinds of, even things I've recorded from phone calls I've had when I ask people, like, could you please put me on hold, which is a question no one knows how to respond to.
Right.
So that's what we do. And we make this music, believe it or not, like very danceable. And People are always very surprised by that. So it's a total delight. I love this project right now. It's sort of my favorite thing at the moment.
I'm not the first person to ask this, but what about implementing any of these tracks into actual hold situations? Is that even on the table?
Like we would take one of our mixes and put it back on hold?
No. You would take one of your mixes and you would somehow get a multinational corporation or what have you to add it to their one of their tracks of hold sounds.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we could. It's interesting to think about how it might sort of just disappear back into that context because, you know, one thing we like to play a lot with is that I have some sound in this set which I've culled from, you know, a high resolution source. It's like, oh, it turns out to be some song on iTunes and I can download it. So that music, when you play it, sounds loud and you can, like, you know, it's got like proper dynamic range and everything. But then there's a lot of stuff recorded off the phone lines which sounds really, really crappy, and, you know, which we are really, really interested in those sonic qualities of like what you would hear through the phone lines, and we mix these things with one another. But it's funny to think how you would just put that stuff back on a phone line, and I think it would just sound like on hold music again. I don't know that anyone would be able to tell.
Okay.
Necessarily.
So So you're transforming it in the moment, in the performance, to become its transcendent self, and yet if you were to sort of put it back into that original context, it wouldn't work, is kind of what you're saying.
I sort of think so, but if like anyone gave me the chance, I would certainly try it out. I mean, we've also, you know, by doing this, discovered these sort of genres now of people who write goofy on hold music knowingly. Like there was one which, you know, was like a country western song that was like, I'm on hold, I can't get off hold. Like they do that,
right?
So that there's sort of a tongue-in-cheek acknowledgement of what's happening. And we have a little bit actually steered away from that stuff. It sort of feels like it's too easy to me to kind of go with something that's already ironic. And actually, you know, really, we're not trying to be ironic with the mix. We're trying to actually turn it into something that's interesting to listen to. And I mean, what's really gratifying is when someone comes up after the set and says, like, I can't believe how, like, interesting and good that music was. Then I feel like we've done a good musical performance.
Right,
like, that's really what I want.
Okay. Well, I you know, it's hard for me not to yearn, I guess, or at least wonder, you know what I mean? As much as I get your objective and that you're succeeding your objective, I mean, this is, I guess it's an opportunity. It's a potential opportunity.
Sure.
To fill those dead, you know, those sort of, I mean, the worst thing about a lot of hold music, and we have to acknowledge that hold music has improved, you know, if incrementally over the years, is that it becomes an earworm, right? So if you're going to get an earworm, you want to get a decent earworm, right?
Yeah. No, fair enough. I mean, you know, that if someone offered me this chance, I would take it. I mean, in the spirit of curiosity, I totally would.
Yeah.
After this last gig, a guy came up to me and said, are you guys going to release this as an album? And I just was dumbfounded. It's like, that's really hilarious that you are asking me this, like, you would want to listen to this.
Right.
And I mean, you know, I told that to Julie and she was like, oh, can you imagine the permissions issues we'd have? And it's true. There is sort of like, none of us want to deal with that part. So no, I don't think we'll ever release it as an album.
Right. Well, for what it's worth, there is a podcast out there that is set up. The structure of it is that people call in and the host talks with them and they stay anonymous and they talk for an hour and they share their stories. And it's really popular. And people, when a tweet goes out saying, hey, call in, you know, tons of people call in, and so many of those people are on hold for an hour or two. Originally, the host was getting a lot of complaints that the whole music was really grim. I guess it was sort of dark kind of music. I don't know the details, but apparently, after getting a lot of complaints, he changed it up, and people are a lot more happy with the whole music. So, maybe your entry point into, you know, getting some version of your whole music out there is to, like, look into some podcasts or what have you where there's a hold situation.
That's interesting.
Just putting that out there.
Yeah. Good to know that.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Well, Nina, tell me when you're heading off to, I know we're getting ahead of things, but when are you heading back off to Berlin?
I'm going for a short visit in the middle of November, sort of over our Thanksgiving school break, and then come mid-December, I am back there for a longer stretch. I have to be back in the U.S. for most of the month of February. There's going to be this traveling retrospective that I have up right now is traveling one last time, so I have to be there to sort of open the last museum venue and install the show, and then trying to kind of check in a bit with school while I'm here again.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So,
okay.
You know, there's sort of a...
And then after you check in, will you be able to go back there through the summer? Or
yeah,
is there...
then I'll be... Mm-hmm. Yeah, then I'll be back there, I think, pretty much, you know, March... Well, I have to come back here again in May, but March, April, back here a little bit in May, and then there for the summer. So, you know, it's kind of... It is definitely a back and forth for me a bit this year.
I have to ask you, I actually asked a guest a couple of episodes ago in a different context, but not too dissimilar. And I noticed this just in looking at one of your projects. I can't remember which one it was, but I'm sure you could tell. Oh, it was actually probably Seat Assignment, which you alluded to earlier. But you clearly do quite a bit of traveling. And you mentioned, I can't remember the term you used earlier, much earlier in this conversation, but there was a certain amount of concern mentioned in relation to it. So how do you feel about your carbon footprint?
Yeah, I don't feel great about it at all. I mean, it's really, no, I don't. And it's
right.
Because I'm really self-conscious about it the more time goes on and the more I learn. I mean, it's really ridiculous. And what this recent decision we made to live this way has not alleviated that, obviously. So
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what to say other than to cop to it, you know, that it's an unreasonable amount to fly. I mean, I know people who fly a lot more than me, but still, you know, it's, this is, I guess, what I've tried to do. I've tried to not make trips where I go somewhere like, you know, these sort of invitations to come and do like a visiting artist trip for 2 days where you get on a plane, you fly. Like, I've sort of started saying no to more of those things and tried to do more of them over Skype. I've tried to sort of do some lectures over Skype instead of, you know, getting on a plane to do that kind of thing. It's not always the same, but I think sometimes even, you know, like chaining together two trips so you make three flights rather than two round trips. Like,
right.
I'm trying to be conscious of this stuff and to sometimes simply just say no because it just feels like, is it really important to do this trip? Probably not. And so, yeah.
What's your sense what's your sense of how art schools and other institutions are in terms of their openness towards having a, you know, a webinar type situation as opposed to in person?
Yeah. I mean, it's not their first choice, but sometimes faced with no contact with that artist and having some contact, they'll settle for it. And, I mean, it's studio visits. I can't really do, I think studio visits over Skype are sort of an absurdity. Like, I think you really have to be in front of the work, but a lecture, you know, I think there are interesting ways to sort of do that. And I'm trying to find forms which make that a kind of thing into itself, like interesting ways to use even the opportunities that the Skype might present to do a different kind of lecture than to stand in front of someone and show a PowerPoint. So, trying to kind of evolve those options. But I have two friends, and this has made a really big impression on me, that one of them, an English artist named Sally O'Reilly, she has made a commitment to never fly again.
Wow,
and,
good
you know,
for her.
She lives in the UK, and she can go to other places in Europe where her career mostly happens, by train or other means. But if she comes to the U.S., she does it by ship, and she doesn't come often. And it's really an amazing gesture. I think that and then I was going to mention my other friend is, in fact, the DJ friend, Gabriel, who just came out to California, and he flies once a year. So he just squandered his one trip of the year to come and do this gig for me, which was incredibly generous.
Yeah.
And I took him on a spectacular bird-watching trip all day Friday to say thank you. And it was glorious. But, I mean, you know, for as much as – and I said this to someone recently who was like, you know what? What they're doing, it's heroic and everything, but it's really not going to make a dent in it. And, okay, I also get that, you know, the impact of each of us individually flying is not going to save the planet. But the point is, I just told you these stories, and the point is that I keep thinking about them making this decision, and I keep telling this story to a lot of people. And I think it's sort of the bigger point is that, like, we have to think about what sacrifices we're willing to make, all of us, on some level, to sort of get this thing to hopefully change. And, you know, I don't know. I go between feeling despairing that it's too late, et cetera, and then sort of thinking that where one can, do what one can. So,
yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
There was this, there's a big name LA artist who I, for some reason, this Instagram post has stuck in my head, not, you know, overstuck, but at least it's come to mind in our conversation. Mm-hmm. It's like a shot from the window out back towards the wing, you know, with a, you know, with a nice vista in the background. And it's something like, coming back from so-and-so, you know, lots of great ideas springing up. And so in relation to what you were saying, I wonder, or in relation to our discussion about plane travel, I wonder if amidst the guilt and what have you, if you do sort of get inspiration / ideas from the perspective one does get from being in the air and that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, travel is great for me.
Yeah, right.
Great
right.
for the planet.
Right.
I mean, sure. Like I love flying. I love traveling. I've grown up doing it. It's like the function of having had family in far-flung places and having, you know, the good fortune of parents who are great travelers and curious to teach us things by taking us to places where we can learn about the world. I mean,
right.
I'm really, really lucky. But,
right.
But you know, there's just a sort of, yeah, I do feel really, really conscious of this right now, sort of what's truly necessary versus what we could maybe skip now and then. And I'm trying to skip a few more often than I used to.
Okay.
So
that's a good start.
Yeah, not enough, but it'll be a beginning. And then, you know, to think about what else we can do.
Okay. I guess I just have one other thing I want to ask you about.
Yeah.
And that is, we're in, you know, in our conversations about around Berlin, you mentioned your husband being there and you will be joining him and you will coming back and then you'll be going back and so on. But so you're essentially kind of in the midst of a long distance relationship. Yes.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's, you know, it's like the separation in the end is 6 weeks, which is really not that long. It's really not that long.
Okay.
But,
so you're back
but,
every
you know,
6 weeks virtually?
Well, I mean, he was here. He came back with me at the end of the summer for a month. And then, you know, we have, like, between the day he left and the time I arrived there, it will be 6 weeks by the time it's all said and done.
Right.
So it's really not that long.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, you know, people think like, oh, you're apart the entire semester, but it's hardly a 4 month separation. It's almost ridiculous how short that amount of time turned out to be. So, I think it's more just that we're going to have more trips of sort of a few weeks where we're not in the same place. But, you know, it's interesting. You fall into your, when we've been together a very long time. I mean, you kind of fall into a very different rhythm when you're on your own for a while. And it's different for, you know, 4 weeks than if someone's just gone for a few days. So I'm quite cognizant right now of the way that I sort of run my morning if it's just me or, you know, decide to kind of, like, what do I do before bed if it's just me. So some of that's, there's some nice sides to that. I've been very spontaneous with calling up my friends and sort of, hey, I'm in this part of town, I'm coming over. You know, usually we'd be sort of planning our day together more than would allow for that kind of detour. But so, you know, trying to, again, back to the sort of philosophy of just be where I am, doing what I'm doing when I'm there. And Berlin will be a whole different, you know, it'll be a different pattern. It'll be mostly then us together doing our thing, me not knowing as many people, me studying German, me sort of holding up during winter, playing with the cat.
Awesome. And, you know, you mentioned the spontaneity of, like, you know, when you're in New York by yourself, calling somebody up and saying, I'm coming over. That's one of the things I miss most about New York is the spontaneous get-together. Have you, speaking of Berlin, would you say there's any degree of spontaneity in that way there? Or is it too early to tell?
It's, you know, it is early, but I would say that does seem to happen more. And, you know, I mean, our closest friends in Berlin actually live downstairs from us. This is the reason we wound up in this particular apartment building.
Right.
And so there is quite a bit of spontaneity with them. And it's sort of like, it almost feels like a sort of return to that college dorm thing where you're like, I'm coming downstairs in my socks. You know, it's really nice. Like, you just can kind of knock on the door and sort of unexpected times and see if someone's home. It's really wonderful. Like, I've had such nostalgia for my freshman dorm, you know, living situation in this weird way of, like, there's always someone around. They're right there.
Right.
Endless distraction and sort of weird, suddenly, like, suddenly down the hall there'd be, like, bunch of people socializing. You're like, what's up? You know, it's so rare that we live that way right now as adults.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah. So that is nice about New York. People are crammed together in a way that, you know, it makes it easier. You're like, oh, I'm only a block away from that person. I'll just go see if they're home.
Yeah.
So I do that. I do that a little more than I used to. Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, Nina, it's been great talking. Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you. It was
yeah.
really fun. I really appreciate this, the time and good questions.
Thank you. Absolutely. And
okay.
we're out. Thank you again so much to Nina for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Definitely a lot of interesting material there. I enjoyed talking to Nina, and I'm glad that she is settling into Berlin, and I'm really glad, too, that Stickies seems to be happy there, as you will see from the images on theconversationpod.com. So we're going to be talking about the T-shirt in a second. Want to fill you in on that, and want to remind you, though, that as we go out on this episode, a good 5-plus-minute chunk of Nina's on-hold music dance party excerpt will be included. So stay tuned for that, please. All right. So here we go. Theconversationpod.com is where you can go and support the show. And now you can support the show by getting a t-shirt. It is the Conversation Pod t-shirt. And let me tell you a little bit about it. First of all, I want to give big thanks for Patrick Kamet in Pittsburgh, who was a high school art teacher there. He's actually going to be printing these silkscreen t-shirts at his school. And he was the one who came to me with a suggestion. He gave me the idea for the P word, which is basically the P-R-A-C-T-I-C-E word. But half the word has turned into expletive symbols. So go to the website to check it out. Better to be seen than heard. And on the back is going to be the Conversations logo. It's going to come in 4 different colors: black, navy blue, charcoal, and dark heather, which is the one that sort of got the slight pattern quality to it. And it's going to come in 2 different thicknesses. There's the 5.3 ounce, which is going to feel like your basic average t-shirt. And then there's also the 4.5 ounce, which is a softer style a la Urban Outfitters or what have you, sort of more contemporary slash hipster shirt, whatever you want to call it. Just a lighter, slightly more breathier type t-shirt. So those are the options in terms of colors and thickness, and the sizes run from small all the way up to triple extra large. So a size for everyone. And now here's the deal as far as how much it's going to cost you. So it's going to be a total of $26.25. That breaks down to $20 for the shirt itself, and then another $6.25 for shipping. That is if you're going to go the Venmo, V-E-N-M-O route. If for those of you not familiar, it's a sort of an alternate to PayPal where you have to join. And it's kind of like a social media version of PayPal, basically. But you can pay somebody directly that way, and you don't get the transaction fee that PayPal charges, 2.9% plus 30 cents for each payment. So unless you can figure out the family way of paying via PayPal, which means there will be no fee, you want to sign up for Venmo, I will give you my, just email what your order is. I will give you my Venmo username, and then you can pay that way. As far as a larger order for the shipping, it's going to be basically the flat rate box of $6.25. Patrick says you can get 3 rolled up shirts in. If you want more than 3 shirts, a medium size box is $12. And that can probably fit in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 shirts. If you want to go higher than that, it's $17, and that should carry 15 shirts if you really want to do a huge order. And this is all per the U.S. Postal Service flat rate fees. So it's pretty much straight shipping fee. $6.25 if you use Venmo. Okay? Now, I have shared these with a few people. They are pretty stoked on them. They're pretty excited. So hopefully you guys are as well. Go check them out front and back on the website. You got to go to theconversationpod.com/support to see these images. I included the black, the heather gray, and the navy samples. I didn't put in the charcoal just because it would have gone an extra line. So if you want to see a copy of that, I can be happy to send that to you. But it's just a lighter version of the black one. So that is the deal with the t-shirts. I hope you guys are excited about that. And one other thing, as far as ordering time, if you order in the next like couple weeks, we can probably get you your shirts in time for the holidays. So the first run, the first round of printing is going to be done in probably in early December, like the first week or so of December. And then you could very likely get them in time for the holidays if you want to send them as holiday gifts. That's the time frame. If I left anything out, I apologize. But, here's the one thing I did leave out. If you are outside the U.S. and you are interested, let's work something out. Obviously, shipping is going to be the determining factor for you, but we can do the math on how much it's going to be to get them to Europe, to Mexico, to Australia, to New Zealand, etc. So if you are interested and up for paying a little extra, we'll work it out. It'll still be only $20 for the shirt itself. We've got to keep it at that just because that's the way the cookie crumbles. And also wanted to let you know that not only is this going to benefit the conversation, but it's also going to benefit Patrick's school, Charleroi High School's Art Club, where they will be raising a little money from these t-shirt sales. And with that fundraising, if we do well enough, it'll get the class, the art club, to visit the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. So think of it as an opportunity to help out these high school art club kids and get them into that Warhol Museum, which they're dying to get into. Okay? Big thanks again to Patrick for initiating this project. And if you have any questions about the t-shirts that I haven't covered, definitely reach out. Otherwise, I hope you guys will start ordering. I think that's about it. I will spare you the usual spiel about the podcast, other than saying that our social media handle is still at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. I've been getting some lovely help from a woman named Divya on Instagram, so you may have noticed a nice bump up in content to go along with the images, as well as slideshow images rather than just standalone. And I'll leave it at that. Let's get into the sampling of Nina's On Hold Music Dance Party. Thank you guys very much for being here, for listening, and I look forward to seeing those t-shirts on you. And I will talk to you in a couple weeks. Ciao for now.
about something else. If none of those sounds right, say, I'm calling about something else. Are you still with me?